Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of April. Baseball this hour. Tom Haudricourt is our guest, author of Brewers Essential, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Real Fan. Stories, statistics, facts, figures, anecdotes, trivia, and more. Tom has been a sports writer for over 30 years, covering the Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. For a brief time, he covered the New York Yankees, but he's been examining the Brewers since 1985. His first book, Where Have You Gone, 82 Brewers, was published last year. And it covers so much. The history is fascinating of this club, and he looks at, you know, what happened last year, what could happen this year, what's happened with the ownership and all of the managers of the team. And we're going to welcome phone calls. I know there are many baseball fans listening, so we hope to hear from you during the course of this hour. After all, it's a generational thing. Parents go, their children go, grandparents go, and it goes on generation after generation after generation, which is one of the truly wonderful things about baseball. Tom is joining us by phone from St. Louis, where he is there with the Brewers, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Hello, Tom. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi,
how
Tom.
Are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thank
Good.
You.
Good. Well, let's start with the story of the Brewers, beginning with the 1969 expansion Seattle Pilots who moved to Milwaukee the following year. It's an amazing story, isn't it?
Well, it is, just because of the timing of it. The equipment truck left spring training not knowing if the team was going to be in Seattle or Milwaukee. And just imagine that. Imagine being in spring training for 6 weeks and not knowing what city you were going to play in. The team was in bankruptcy in Seattle, and the Brewers, Bud Selig and his group, were trying to purchase it. And they told the equipment truck driver to go to Las Vegas and wait until they call him, and he was either going to turn left and go to Seattle or turn right and go to Milwaukee.
And they didn't even really have uniforms.
No, they ripped the Seattle off the front of their jerseys and very hastily sewed Milwaukee on. You know, where is Betsy Ross when you really need her? And I think it's hilarious that they were only able to go so far. They were only able to get the uniforms, which they wore the caps. They took off the S and put the M, but they still had those, I think they call them the scrambled eggs on the brim, like an admiral. And, you know, Milwaukee's a little nautical on Lake Michigan, but not quite, you know, not like the Seattle Pilots.
So
they were almost wearing home-stitched uniforms there at the start.
Mm-hmm. And they were amazed. This is an amazing baseball town, but they were, I think, flabbergasted by the kind of reception they received.
They were. They weren't drawing in Seattle, so they were used to playing in front of close friends and family. And then they get to Milwaukee, and they pretty much get welcomed at the airport with a pep rally. And the players soon found out that going to Milwaukee was a good thing.
Yeah. And tell me about Bud Selig's role in all of this, starting actually when he was a kid and the team left town and went to Atlanta and he walked away. You can just see Bud doing this, walk around town with tears in his eyes, feeling so sad because there was no baseball and he loved it.
Right. The best thing that Milwaukee had going for them as a city looking for a baseball team was that Bud Selig was a tremendous baseball fan.
Yeah.
You know, beyond just wanting a team for civic pride and business and all of that. He was a true baseball fan. His mom took him to games when he was little all over the country, and he became a baseball fan. And he always told me that one of the saddest days of his life was when he went to the Milwaukee Braves' last game at County Stadium.
Yeah. How did the early Brewers do, Tom?
They weren't very good, Kathleen.
No.
Bud told me that on opening day they lost like by 12 runs or something, and Bud said it was the only day ever he didn't worry about the score because he was just so happy to have the team. But I guarantee you Bud started worrying about the scores shortly after that.
Mm-hmm.
And they just weren't good. You know, the Seattle team was an expansion team, and it does take you a while to get your footing under you when you are an expansion team. And so They were, the word dreadful comes to mind for the way they were for several years.
Dreadful. Ugh. And at one point, I didn't really remember this story or even know this story, that they wanted to buy the White Sox. The White Sox had played some games at County Stadium?
Before Bud got the team out of bankruptcy in Seattle, to just try to keep baseball alive in Milwaukee. He had the White Sox play a few of their games in Milwaukee. They weren't drawing well at Old Comiskey, and their owners were a little upset about that. They went up to Milwaukee and drew very well. So Bud, two brothers own the team, and Bud struck a deal with one of the brothers to buy the White Sox and move them to Milwaukee. And then the other brother had reservations and bought his brother out of the team and kept him in Chicago. And once again, Bud was heartbroken. He thought, you know, no, we're not going to get baseball in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. It's been, when you think about it, so many years of struggle, including the new stadium that we have now. There's always been a bit of a fight about everything.
It has, and it wasn't really until Miller Park got built and the team signed a 30-year lease that we just knew baseball was going to be around for a long time in Milwaukee. It's I've covered the team since 85, as you mentioned, and, you know, there was a time where I thought they might move, and every ballpark battle is a heated one. Every city that's ever done one, it always gets heated, and politics come into play, and so on and so forth. And I just think it's remarkable that the city fathers built County Stadium on spec.
I know. Isn't that remarkable?
I mean, they had to have been nervous about that, Kathleen. They had to have said, are we messing up? You know, what happens if we have this big white elephant with no ball team? And within months after building it, the Boston Braves moved to Milwaukee. They were so fortunate.
How in the world did that get through when you think about the controversy concerning the recent stadium? We build County Stadium and we don't have a team.
Can you imagine if they had a city council meeting today in Milwaukee and said, you know, we'd like this new facility. We don't have a team for it, and we don't know if we're going to have a team for it, but we would like the citizens to pay for the stadium. The people would bring torches and burn the castle down.
Right.
You know, they wouldn't stand for something like that.
Right. So how did it happen? How did they get here?
Just some tremendous foresight by the city fathers back then. Bud Selig used to tell me about, he was a little kid and up there on Story Parkway sitting there and watching them build a stadium and saying, wow, I can't believe we're getting a stadium. I wonder if we're going to get a team.
It was also a part of an expansion of Milwaukee, right? The museum was being built.
Exactly.
There was more going on. We were making ourselves a big league city.
They were. It's exactly right. And like I said, it takes a lot of foresight, but I don't think in modern day it could ever happen again.
Yeah, I think you're right. The book starts with a foreword by Gorman Thomas, and you talk about the fact that few players, if any, who have worn a Milwaukee Brewers uniform have been more really beloved by the team's fans than Gorman Thomas, a blue-collar player in a blue-collar town who has remained tied to the team, who loved the team.
He sure does, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank Gorman for writing the foreword. I think that's a very crucial part of my book because I wanted a voice from the playing ranks to show people just how special Milwaukee is to a lot of those players. And like you said, Gorman still to this day has a personal services contract with the team and can be often seen out at County Stadium. And he told me the saddest day of his life was the day they traded him to Cleveland. And I think it's a trade that everybody rued afterward. But Gorman, like you said, he was a blue-collar guy in a blue-collar town. Gorman and some of the guys sometimes would go out after games into the parking lot in uniforms and have a beer and a brat. And, there's another thing you won't see in the modern-day atmosphere.
Yeah. And there was baseball has changed so much. You talk about C-League remembering the days when players were identified with teams for a long period of time, and this moving moment at a restaurant somewhere, a fast food restaurant, where Robin Yount is thinking about leaving the team. It's hard to imagine Robin Yount not being a brewer and Bud having this conversation with him.
Yeah, and trying to say to him, you know, Robin, you're a brewer. You know, you just can't go elsewhere. And Bud wasn't sure how that was going to work out, and he personally flew to Phoenix and, like you said, went to a fast food restaurant with Robin. They tried to go to a place, you know, where nobody would see him and just sit down and talk. And he sort of played onto Robin's sentiments for Milwaukee. Robin loved Milwaukee. The only reason Robin was thinking about leaving was the team wasn't doing well, and he really wanted to go back to a World Series. And in the end, Robin agreed to stay, and I think that he really was happy that he did, and he enjoyed his 20 years in Milwaukee. But you just don't see that anymore. You don't see the longtime players with free agency and money being what it is. And, you know, fans kind of root for uniforms these days instead of players because the players change so much.
Yeah, it's too bad, isn't it?
It is, because we had Robin Yount and Jim Cantor and Paul Molitor played together for 15 years in Milwaukee. And, And we'll never see that again. It'd be lucky to see one player play for 15 years, much less three.
It would have been a little bit more time on Young because he was injured. He switched positions. He played them both absolutely beautifully. He was so, so much a hard worker, wasn't he?
He was. One of the things I tried to do in this book, Kathleen, was have players tell me stories that I had never heard before, and therefore I would hope the fans hadn't, because we pretty much know the history on the field and that they went to the 82 World Series and so on and so forth, but I wanted some stories in this book that people would read and say, wow, I didn't know that. And Robin told me the story of when he was 19 years old and he was in spring training, and it was getting towards the end of spring training, and they hadn't cut him yet, and he was wondering if he was going to make the team, and he had only played 1 year. Excuse me, he was 18 years old, and he was only played 1 year in the minors, and they were on the bus going to a game in spring training, and Del Crandall, the manager, calls him up to the front of the bus, and Robin said he just knew that Crandall was going to say, you know, kid, you've had a good camp, but we're going to be sending you down, and thanks, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. He just knew that's what Del Crandall was going to tell him, and he was afraid to even go up to the front seat to get the bad news, and he said that he sat down next to Crandall, and all of a sudden Crandall says, we're going to keep you, and you're going to be our shortstop. And he was flabbergasted. Can you imagine Kathleen, an 18-year-old kid, and all of a sudden he's been told he's going to be a major league shortstop?
Isn't that something? 18 years old. And then to stay with the team for 20 years.
Yeah, and he had some rough years. People think that Robin was a star right away. He wasn't. In his second year in the major leagues, he made 44 errors.
Hmm.
44. They wouldn't even let you stay in the major leagues these days if you did that. But he was a raw kid, and they just knew it. They watched him to make sure that he didn't break mentally because, you know, when you're young and you struggle, sometimes it can get to you mentally, and then you become a defeated player. They never saw that with Robin. And they realized at a very early age that he was the right kind of guy mentally and that he would get past all of this.
Yeah, let's talk about this mental aspect of the game. I find this fascinating. There's so much pressure on you. You have to concentrate so much. You've got sometimes 50,000 people. Some might be booing. Some might be cheering. You got all this noise happening. How do you prepare yourself? And there are probably as many stories as there are players. But how do you prepare yourself mentally for this experience? And there are so many of them. They play game after game after game.
Well, you just hit on the key aspect of this whole thing. They play every day, Kathleen. And how do you stay even keel? And how do you stay mentally sharp? And how do you stay ready to play? You know, in football, they'll practice all week for a game. And then on Sunday, they're just, you know, shooting fire and brimstone out their nostrils, and they're just ready to go, and they kind of work themselves into a ladder and go play. And then basketball, they play like two or three times a week, and they kind of get up for games. But baseball, you're playing every day, and if you are on a mental roller coaster, you're going to just exhaust yourself by the end of the year. And also in baseball, when you're a regular player, there's going to be four times a game, maybe five, where you're one-on-one against the pitcher. You know, in football, if you're a guard or player in the line, you may have an anonymous game where they really don't pay much attention to you the whole game. But in baseball, four or five times a night, you're in that batter's box all by yourself, and it's you, and everybody's watching you, and you can't hide. There's nowhere to hide. And when you think about baseball, a 300 batting average is considered excellent, a Hall of Fame material. Well, that means you're failing 7 out of 10 times.
Mm.
Can you imagine if Brett Favre would have had 7 incompletions out of every 10 passes, or if Michael Redd missed 7 out of every 10 shots? They wouldn't keep you.
Right.
But
right.
In baseball, 30% success rate at the plate is considered Hall of Fame material, and that's why you'll often hear it said that hitting a baseball is the hardest thing to do in sport.
That's what I've heard. Is that true?
Well, it's coming at you 95 miles an hour. They say you have somewhere around 1 second to make up your mind whether it's going to be across the plate or not and start your bat. You have a round bat hitting a round ball, so the surface is very small. It's not like you're using a big old flat, you know, plank of wood. You got that round bat, round ball. If you don't square it up exactly, you're going to pop it up or hit it on the ground.
Right.
I got to believe it is the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm. I can't believe people can throw that fast, Tom. Now, how can anybody do that?
Well, that's why they get hurt so much, too. The pitchers, if you watch in slow motion, the arm angles that pitchers use when they pitch, it's not a natural. Throwing underhanded is way more natural than throwing overhanded. And these guys are not just throwing 95 straight. They're throwing curveballs and sliders and split-fingered balls that dive into the ground. You know, they got all kinds of movement on the ball, and there's all kinds of torque on their arm. it's a tough thing, and that's why pitchers make so much money, because it's a lot of hazards to that particular position on the field.
So why didn't the game just start with people throwing underhanded? Why not?
Well, you see, every now and then you'll see what we call a submarine pitcher, a guy who kind of comes from down under, and it does remind you of, like, fast-pitch softball, and you know, kinesiologists and all of that, all those people will tell you it's way more natural to throw from down under than over top, that it's definitely going to hurt your shoulder.
Yeah. Well, let's talk, and I was here during that year, and oh my gosh, this town was so happy. 82, they go to the World Series. How did they make it there?
Well, it's what a season. They were in first place, and they go to Baltimore for the final weekend of the series. The final weekend of the season, and they're up by 3 games, and they have 4 games to play, so they only have to win 1 game, and then they'll knock the Orioles off and win their first division crown. And so they go in, and the first night, and they get just absolutely killed. Mm. They just get, you know, bombed out of the ballpark. And so, okay, no big deal. The next day, they had a makeup doubleheader. So, Kathleen, I've been covering baseball a long time, and I'd say 75% of all doubleheaders end in splits. You know, one team wins one game and one the other. It's just kind of the way the odds work out. So they figured certainly they'll win one of those games and clinch the division. Well, they not only don't win either game, they get, you know, slaughtered in both games again, just not even in either game. So now all of a sudden the Orioles have drawn even with them. It's 1 game left. The Brewers are reeling. They come to Memorial Stadium in Baltimore on that final Sunday, and fans have brooms in the stands, you know, chanting sweep, sweep, sweep. Very hostile environment, and they're facing Jim Palmer, a future Hall of Fame pitcher. They had everything against them, and it didn't look good, but, you know, the Brewers felt confident in Don Sutton, their pitcher that day, who they had acquired late in the season and, you know, from Houston, and who made a big difference in them winning the pennant. And they went out and they not only beat the Orioles, they really whomped them good, and Robin hit a couple of home runs. And all of a sudden, here they are. You know, they've won their division, and for the first time, they go to the playoffs. And they, Robin Yount told me that there was so much emotion and tension released that day that by the time they got out to California to play the Angels in the first round of the playoffs, they actually were exhausted mentally and physically, and they went and they got beat the first 2 games in California. Mm-hmm. And back then, it was best of 5. So they come back to Milwaukee, and they're down 2-0 and 1 more loss, and they're done. And they said the fans were, the stadium was so electric, County Stadium was so electric, 50,000 people, and they said it just lifted their spirits. And they came back and won all 3 games in Milwaukee and went to the World Series.
And the party started in this town.
I wasn't. Were you here then?
Yeah, I was here.
Yeah, I heard it. You would know better than me. I didn't get there until 85, but I heard Wisconsin Avenue was up for grabs.
You're right. It was a good year. And we need another one.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Players told me that it was so wild when they won the pennant that those who were staying downtown, you know, a lot of the players just, like, rent hotel rooms and stuff like that because they're just there for a few minutes. They said you could not drive your car. Some of them walked back to their hotels, and then I heard, I forget which player it was, they put a pickup truck and a bunch of players piled in the back, and they put, like, a tarp over them so people could see them so they could sneak back home.
Tom Hardercourt is our guest. His book is Brewers Essential, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Real Fan, Stories and Statistics, Facts, Figures, Anecdotes, Trivia, and More. It has been published by Triumph, just released, and we're happy to have Tom with us. Our phone lines are filled, but keep the number in mind, and you'll get through. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can send an email, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's get a phone calls now for Tom. Ed from Brooklyn. Hi, Ed.
Well, Kathleen, the first baseball game in this country was pitched underhand. So there is that history.
Uh-huh.
What we need to talk about, there are a couple issues here, at least with the stadium, with County Stadium, there was a tremendous battle. That ballpark really didn't get built until 1951. The Northside supervisors wanted it by Dineen Park on 68th and Keith. The Southside supervisors wanted it by the airport. And we live now with the results of that decision to put it on a swamp and a quarry. And Miller Park has tremendous design defects. And Selig wanted to keep the ballpark the new Parobar on that site. So we actually live with a decision that was made way back in 1950, which was a compromise site, to put it in the middle of the county. The other thing is that the Brewers have never developed, save for Moose Haas, they have never developed a quality starting pitcher. All of the quality pitchers that have come in this organization, Mike Caldwell, Don Sutton, later in the 80s, Teddy Higuera, have been the result of trades or going down to Mexico and bringing Higuera up. This is really telling about this organization. The fact that Moose Haas is really the only 130-game winner that this organization has developed. And I think that Mr. Hardicourt should address these two issues.
Tom?
Well, as far as the stadium goes, I mean, I think we all know about the battles of whether it should have been downtown or where it was. The one thing I will say about that is it certainly is not hurting attendance. The Brewers drew $2.8 million last year, and I'm pretty certain they're going to draw $3 million this year, which in their market is a remarkable number. Mm-hmm. So at least it is not hurting their attendance, and I think having a competitive team in the ballpark is a big part of that. As far as the pitching, that's absolutely right. They have had trouble developing pitchers over the years. Now, as far as going down to Mexico, they did go and sign Teddy Higuera, and then they did develop him in their farm system. So there is some player development involved with him, and he was a 20-game winner, then unfortunately got hurt. Same thing with Juan Nieves, another pitcher who has their only no-hitter. He was signed out of a prep school in Connecticut, and they developed him, and then he unfortunately got hurt early in his career. So they've had some real problems with injuries. Ben Sheets, who's a homegrown pitcher and probably their best pitcher over the last several years when he's healthy, another pitcher that they've developed that has had trouble staying healthy. So they've really had some unfortunate problems with players from their system being hurt. But right now, it looks like they're finally starting to turn the corner just a little bit. They have Giovanni Gallardo, who is one of their draft picks, who will be joining the team this weekend after having minor knee surgery in spring training. And then Manny Parra and Carlos Villanueva, who they also, Villanueva was traded for, but at an early age and developed within their system. And Parra is one of their draft picks. But there's no question about it. They've had trouble developing their own pitchers, and they, with the pitching salaries being what they are today, they are more focused on that than ever, of developing their own pitchers. Sure. And they have some more in the pipeline, and they think they're finally starting to turn the corner in that regard.
Steve from Monona, Iowa. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Kathleen. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Say, I am a 57-year-old diehard baseball fan and a lifetime Yankee fan, so I can hear the boos already. But I live in Northeast Iowa, and I listen to Brewers baseball because you guys have a national treasure in that Bob Uecker.
Oh, yeah.
And I will listen off the air.
All right. Thanks for the call.
And I, Kathleen, I have a chapter on Bob in my mm-hmm. book, just on Bob, in which I relate some of the things he said at his Hall of Fame induction speech in Cooperstown. And it was the closest thing to a stand-up comedy act they've ever had in Cooperstown. And they usually, this is a true story, the Hall of Famers, the living Hall of Famers, sit up on the stage during the induction, and it's quite hot in Cooperstown that time of year, and they're up there sweating and suffering, and they usually are whispering to the whoever's talking to, get off the stage, get off your, you know, because they want to get out of the heat. Well, the day that Uke was up there, he had them rolling in the aisles, crying, dabbing at their eyes. No one asked him to leave that day. He was told to stay as long as he wanted.
He is so gifted at what he does, isn't he? He is so, and it's got to be such a hard job.
Yeah, see, I, as a writer, I can step away from my computer, go get a drink, go use the bathroom, go do whatever I want to do. But when you're doing radio or TV, they're sitting there the whole time,
right,
keeping the game alive for either listeners or viewers. I envy what they do. Those are tough jobs.
Yeah, he's good. Scott from La Crosse, hi.
All right, Kathleen. First of all, let me just say to you, do me a favor, okay? Take care of your sweet self.
I will, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, what I'd like to talk about is, first of all, player loyalty. And this relates to my Brewers story, but it has to do with Kirby Puckett, who a few years, when he was in his prime, was offered a contract to go someplace else for more money, turned it down. It was something like, in those days, money, $6 million, and he took $5 million to stay with the Twins. Well, you know, he didn't miss a meal, obviously, and for that $1 million lost income, he bought goodwill that later on in his career and in his life brought him so much and made him such a legend. And if I were an agent, I would be telling these players, you know, let's think about what the big picture is here, because that's something that you just can't trade in. Now, my Kirby Puckett story was at the Old County Stadium, and it was the third day of a 3-game series, and the Twins were just beating the Brewers to death. It was Kirby Puckett leading the charge, making fantastic plays in center field, and by late Sunday afternoon in that series, he'd gone something like 10 for 11 and hit a couple of home runs. And I'm sitting out in the bleachers, you know, everybody's out there, everybody's been drinking beer, and I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, what's this drunken crowd going to do when this little guy comes out to center field for the late innings? And he comes trotting out there, and you see him sort of look up at us, because he really has been devastating. And just as one, everybody in the bleachers got up and started giving him a standing ovation. Mm. Pretty soon the entire county stadium was on its feet for this guy. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm really proud to be here as a Brewer fan today, because this is cool.
Oh, that is cool.
And Kathleen, as an addendum to that story, that day, that Sunday that he's talking about, when Kirby Puckett went 5 for 5, hit 2 home runs, and I want to say he stole a grand slam away from Robin by jumping up over the fence and pulling it back in. Robin Yount told me years later that was the single greatest game he ever saw a player have on his team or anyone else's team. And that was a very magnanimous thing to say. And isn't it nice to hear that the visiting fans can cheer a player and not boo him? I think that's great.
It's something you'll always remember, Scott. Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our phone number, we have a couple lines open now if you'd like to join in our conversation with Tom. Tom Hundercard is our guest, and his book is Brewers Essential, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Real Fan. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. So, all right, those of us who are vegetarians in our audience will take issue with this, but I've heard this at my kitchen table from my son, actually. Colleen from Dakota, Minnesota writes, Prince needs to be eating meat again, who's obviously worried about the recent news that he became a vegetarian after reading his wife's books about factory farming.
Yeah, you know, Prince is hearing a lot of that these days, because, you know, he hit 50 home runs last year, Kathleen, the most in the National League, and the youngest player ever to hit 50. And this year he has no home runs so far through 13 games, and which could happen to any player, that, you know, go in a little home run slump for a few weeks. But because he previously announced the vegetarian thing, he is now hearing from the meat eaters of the world.
Oh, no.
Please have a cheeseburger.
Oh, no.
And, you know, players are very superstitious.
I'm sure, yeah.
And so when things don't go their way, they're often apt to change. And I just wonder if this goes on much longer, if any cow in the Midwest will be safe, you know, if Prince will rethink. But his is a lifestyle choice. It's not a dietary thing as much as a lifestyle choice. And,
right.
And he says he's going to stick with it, so we'll see. But he's being tested. Mm-hmm. He's definitely being tested, because he, you know, he isn't hitting home runs, and so everybody's going to look for reasons, and that one sort of sticks out.
Right. Mike is next from Berlin. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Just a real quick question, and I'll take the answer off the air. I grew up outside of Boston, big-time Red Sox fan, but moved to Wisconsin in 89, so I've kind of adopted the Brewers as my second team. I was a little ticked when Bud Selig had decided to move the Brewers from the American League to the National League, and it strikes me as strange, you know, with parity in baseball, that the Brewers are now stuck in a very competitive division with 6 teams. There is another division in the National League with only 4 teams. Every single other division in baseball has 5 teams. Did that pan out to be kind of a bad move for the Brewers' part and for baseball in general?
Well, what actually happened was Kansas City was given the first choice. They needed they wanted to realign baseball, and they had expanded to 30 teams, and they needed somebody to switch so that they would have 16 and 14, because if you have an odd number of teams, somebody's going to have to be off every night in each league, and they didn't want that. So Kansas City was actually given the first choice to switch leagues, and they were scuffling back in the late 90s, and Bud thought that they would jump at the opportunity because St. Louis is right down the road and that they would have a natural rivalry with the Cardinals, and he thought they would do it, and he was sort of flabbergasted when Kansas City said, no, we're going to stay with our American League ties. And so Bud, you know, was interim commissioner and owner of the Brewers. You know, he volunteered for his team. No one else really seemed to want to do it. He volunteered for his team to switch over. You know, and at the time, Cleveland was a power. And the Cleveland Indians were a power in the American League Central, and it looked like the Brewers were getting away from a situation that was not going to be good for them. And they went to the National League Central, and which was kind of a thin division back then, but now has become a really good division. And as he pointed out, it is the only six-team division, so it's a tough division. But, you know, they led all last year, first place the whole year, and then at the very end lost by two games to the Cubs. So they certainly think they can be competitive in the division they're in. And, boy, this rivalry with the Cubs, Kathleen, have you been to a Brewers-Cubs game?
Yes.
It's wild, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, very wild.
You know, they call Miller Park Wrigley Field North when they play the Cubs, because so many Illinois interlopers come up and get the tickets. But it's that's grown into quite the rivalry, and it's fun to watch those teams go after each other.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your call. Tell me about this, what turned out to be fabulous PR move, the year that this happened when Bud Selig brought Hank Aaron back.
Yes, you know, and this goes back to what you and I were talking about earlier, Kathleen, that the team was pretty dreadful those early years, and Bud was looking for anything to, you know, kind of get some juice going and get the people behind the team and just anything that would be a PR thing. And Bud, of course, had become fairly close to Hank from when the Milwaukee Braves were in town, and Hank came up through that system. And, you know, Hank had broken Babe Ruth's record in Atlanta, and really that was all there was for him left down there. And he had always loved Milwaukee, always had considered it kind of his hometown. And so when Bud approached the Braves about, you know, maybe bringing Hank back to finish his career in Milwaukee, and he was, you know, in his 40s and kind of towards the end of his career, the Braves broached the subject with Hank, and Hank jumped at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
when they worked out a trade at the winter meetings one year, and they brought Hank back. And it was quite the thing, and Hank was really excited to come back. And when they came back and they had Hank Aaron Day and all that, I understand the place was really electric.
Mm-hmm. And you also write about, I think it was Robin Yount again, who couldn't believe that Hank Aaron was on the team, and he was saying, should I talk to him? Is it okay to talk to him? Here's my hero, and he's sitting right next to me.
Yeah, you're 19 years old, or whatever Robin was at the time. You're a kid, really, and here's the all-time home run champ, Kathleen, and really just an idol, and almost a bigger-than-life figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so Robin's wondering, you know, should I talk to him, or what? And they found out Hank was the nicest, sweetest man in the year. I know Hank very well. I used to cover the Richmond Braves, a minor league team in Richmond, Virginia, and Hank Aaron was the farm director, and I got to know him quite well. And when he comes to town, we still talk and check in with each other. And he's a very nice man. And the players came to see he was just another guy. You know, when you see him over across the field or on television, and you know he broke Babe Ruth's record, and you say, boy, I wonder if this guy's even approachable. They loved him. And Jim Gantner, you know, Hank was the DH. So when the team was in the field, he would be in the dugout. He didn't play a position in those latter years. And Jim Gantner, who was another young player on the team, said he would sit next to Hank on the bench. Jim was not a regular player yet. He had just come up, and he said he would sit next to Hank, and Hank would talk strategy with him the whole game. And he said, it's like I was in baseball college with the greatest professor ever, and he's mm-hmm. telling me everything he knows and passing on all of his insights and wisdoms. And Jim Gantner says he couldn't believe he was sitting next to Hank Aaron, and the guy was telling him all this stuff.
Mm. And then the story about the 755th home run, and he never got the ball.
No, that's such an odd thing.
Well, yeah.
You know, of course, at the time, you don't know it's going to be your last home run.
Right.
It was in July, and there was a couple months left in the season, but Hank was starting to fade a little bit physically and not play as much, and he hits a home run, and it goes just over the fence, and a member of the grounds crew gets it, and, you know, there's a lot of he said, they said back from that scenario, and And I don't know who's right. And, you know, supposedly the kid just wanted to beat Hank and give him the ball, and the club wanted to just get the ball from him and give it to Hank. And he never did get the ball, and I think it went up for auction later, and I'm not sure exactly where it is right now to this very day. Mm. But that was an unfortunate thing, but you just don't know that it's going to be your last home run. And we've seen with all of these auctions the last few years with Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds and stuff that, you know, these balls sell for millions of dollars now.
Yeah, right. Steve from Waupaca, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, a comment. I'm taking my son, Garrett, to his first baseball game on his birthday next week, and he'll be 8 months old, so I'm starting him early as a Brewer fan. And then I'd just like to hear a couple predictions on how the team's going to do this year and in the coming years, and their odds on keeping Braun and Fielder around.
Well, those are all tough questions. There's no question the Brewers have more talent on their team now than they've had in a long, long time. And, you know, we just talked about how tough the division is, and there are a lot of teams that are strong teams in the National League Central. But the Brewers are sort of positioning themselves for the long run. They don't want to be, you know, granted they would love to make the playoffs just one time and go from there, but they also, Mark Attanasio, the owner, has said many times they don't want to win once and then be bad for years after that. They want to build for the future and keep a decent team. So they do have this young core of players, and they have started to talk to some of them about signing long-term contracts, in particular the two players that he just mentioned, Ryan Braun and Prince Fielder. Now, I don't know how those talks will end up. Right now, the players sometimes make more money going year to year than signing the long-term deals. And if you're confident in your ability, a lot of times that's the way you want to do it. But I do give credit to the current ownership for trying to tie up their players. And since Mark Attanasio has taken over as owner, his group has tripled the payroll, and they are willing to commit dollars to the future. So I do think they are committed to being good in the long term and not just the short term.
Anything else, Steve?
Yeah.
Steve's gone. Thanks so much for your call. Mark from Colfax. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I haven't been able to catch all the show. I'm wondering if you talked about the Brewers' very first game at County Stadium.
Well, I don't know if we talked about the very first game. We talked about when they did come. And yeah, I think I did mention they got walloped in that first game, I believe,
yeah.
At Bud Selig.
We had all skipped out of school. I was in high school.
And, oh, no.
Oh, yeah. And I went down there and, of course, sitting in the bleachers. And I think it was against the Angels.
Correct, that's true.
And I think maybe they lost 12-2 or something. But I remember, or maybe they didn't even score, because I remember late innings, they finally got a hit, and we had a guy on first base, and I'll be darned if the stadium didn't give him a standing ovation.
Aww.
You know, opening day is a kind of a special day, Kathleen. It's, you know, the people come, and a lot of times they can't even remember who won, and I do think a little beer is involved.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But, yeah, as we said earlier, it was the one day that Bud Selig said he didn't even care who won the game. He was just so happy, and I understand the place was packed and exciting, and it's nothing like getting a new baseball team and bringing a team to your town.
Yeah, quite a thing to do. How did you explain your absence the next day, Mark?
Actually, it was no problem. I mean, it was a big deal in Milwaukee that you just let teachers and parents know that we're going to the game.
Yeah.
and it was okay.
Kathleen, I remember these days.
Beer and the age had turned down to 18, so it was a good time.
Yeah.
Kathleen, I'm sure you can remember doing this. I know, if you were a baseball fan as a youngster, you know, we would cut out from school early when they used to play the World Series in the afternoon and see them on TV. And, of course, they don't play day games in the World Series. It's all about TV ratings and money now. But, yeah, we used to try to get out of school a little bit early to go watch baseball. And it's no greater feeling as a kid to get out of any part of school to go watch baseball.
right. Or bring the radio and put it in your iPod or whatever and listen when you're in your math class.
Exactly. Slip away whether you're actually physically there or not.
Yeah, exactly. More phone calls in a moment. Tom Hauntercourt is our guest this hour. His book is Brewers Essential, everything you need to know to be a real fan. Stories, statistics, facts, figures, anecdotes, trivia, and more. He's been a sports writer for 32 years, covers the Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And his first book, Where Have You Gone? 82 Brewers, was published just last year. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Tom, and we go to Ona from Richmond, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, thank you. You were mentioning earlier real fast about the noise, and as a softball player, I found that I didn't hear any noise, even though there's a lot of noise behind me when I was concentrating, and I'm assuming that's the same way with the baseball players when they're concentrating. Mm. There's no noise. They're just focused on what they're doing. Mm. But as a former Cubs fan, now Brewer fan.
All right.
I have to say that, first of all, I don't have a problem with the stadium. See, at Wrigley Field, there's no parking. You have to walk. You have to park blocks away, 30, 40 bucks. I mean, to me, I think it's great. I have no problem with the stadium. But I just want to applaud the Brewers fans because sitting in Wrigley Field, it's a status symbol. Everyone's on their cell phone. No one's watching the game. Everyone's there because they're at Wrigley Field. And going to a Brewers game, there's people sitting there and they're watching the game. They're interested in their team. And that's what turned me. It was listening to Bob Uecker one day talk about how beautiful the day was and there's all these open seats. And I kept thinking, you know, in Wrigley Field, they'd be filled. And yet the Brewers, they can't get people to come in. And I thought, you know, this is too good of a team to have people come in and not pay
attention. We just lost your cell phone, yeah.
But you know what, Kathleen? She makes such a good point. You know, say what you will about whether you like where Miller Park is located or not, but two things that are undeniable. And I go all over the country and go out of every ballpark in the country, and I know the intricacies of in and out of all the stadiums. And County Stadium is one of the easier stadiums right. to get in and out of with the freeway being right there. And the other thing is, tailgating is such a part of life at Brewers games. And I go all over the country, and I don't see that either. I used to do to some extent, but not like the Brewers. And on opening day and beautiful weekend, sometimes it's the second or third inning before people even get into the ballpark, and they're having a good time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wonder if we had a downtown stadium with no parking, how that would have all played out.
Right. Thanks, Ona, for your call. Tom from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, thank God we didn't have the stadium downtown, huh? And it's a perfect location out there. My comment is, I remember when I was in grade school, the teachers actually used to put the World Series on TV for us. And, you know, I went to a Catholic school in Milwaukee, and for some reason they did that, and it was great, even though obviously the Brewers were not in at that point.
Boy, the teachers of the year right there, right?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't every game. It was just, you know, every once in a while. I think it was a sports fan nun that used to throw it on for us. So it was good.
Yeah.
I think, Kathleen, if a teacher would have said, you know, get your work done by 3 o'clock and we're going to watch the World Series, boy, would I have gone
fast
and done my work.
Yeah, I'll bet you would have. That's a great story, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Lines are open if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. An email from Kurt from Superior. Please, Tom, comment on Don Money. He's my favorite Brewer of all time. Would he ever get a chance to manage the Brewers? I think the Brewers should retire his number 7.
Wow. Well, you know what? Yeah, Don Money manages the Brewers Double-A team in Huntsville. They're second rung down from the big leagues. They think a lot of him. He's a really good instructor and a really good manager. And who knows? Maybe one day he will. And, you know, there's always a chance to move up. They've moved up people through their system onto their staff. But they really like the way he works with young players. And he used to be in Beloit where they had, you know, some of their really young players when they had a team there. And he was really good with them. And, you know, he is a big part of the Brewers' history and a very, very popular player to this very day. I know when he came back for the 25th anniversary last year of the 82 team, lots of fans loved to see him. And he's a very, very nice man.
Mm-hmm. Another email, Eric from Marengo, the baseball movie starring Charlie Sheen and Bob Uecker, one of the greatest radio announcers on the air, maybe ever, this listener says. Although set in Cleveland, was actually filmed at County Stadium, and the storyline seemed eerily similar to the Brewers organization. Was there any inspiration, such as Wendy Selig's tenure as team president?
You know, I don't know, but Kathleen, I remember that year they were filming that movie Major League out at County Stadium. And as your emailer pointed out, it was actually, you know, in the movie set in Cleveland. And every night after the Brewers would finish their game, this movie crew would go out and put all these new signs and postings up and made it and transformed it into Cleveland Stadium for the movies. And then the actors would come out in their baseball uniforms, and they would film the movie at like 2 and 3 in the morning, and they would have extras from around the city come and sit in the stands, and it was weird. You'd play the real game every night, and then while we were up in the press box working on our stories, we'd be watching a movie being made.
Oh, my. That was fun.
And to this day, if you look, if you watch Major League and you look closely, you'll see things like out on the scoreboard, the WTMJ logo and stuff like that. You'll see stuff from the Milwaukee that you realized that they were making this stadium look like Cleveland, but it wasn't.
Yeah. We go next to John from Wauwatosa. Hi, John.
I just want to say that the final score of the first game was 12-0. It was a nice connection between the California Angels because Fred Haney was the general manager of the California Angels at the time, managed the 57 and 58 championship Braves. And I'd just like to remind everybody how important Marshall Edwards was to the 82 team. If people remember in that final game against the Angels, they substituted for Gorman Thomas. They put Marshall in center field, and Don Baylor hit a screaming line drive, and Marshall Edwards caught the ball, but it's problematic if Gorman could have made that play. So a real unsung hero was Marshall Edwards.
You're exactly right. And what had happened is Gorman had banged up a knee sliding into the plate earlier in that series. And so, yeah, one of the better substitutions ever made by a manager. Harvey Keene put Marshall Edwards out in center, and as your caller just said, Don Baylor hit this tremendous drive. And when I did my book last year on the 82 Brewers, Marshall Edwards said he actually lost track of the ball for a moment, and he actually heard a fan scream out, "Over here, over here," and he turned his head, and at the last second he saw it and leaped and caught it.
Oh, huh. Thank you so much, John, for the call. I find it remarkable that people can remember all the minutiae of all these games that took place years and years ago.
It's why, Kathleen, that Bud Selig has told us millions of times it's a social institution. It's, you know, a community love and project, you know, that these people remember these things. And I'm lucky if I can remember what happened in the eighth inning last night. And I'm covering the team.
Oh, you remember a fair. Sure. You've written a book about it. We should just mention, because we're running out of time, some of the other players that you've highlighted in the book and why you chose to do so.
Right. I talked about, you know, obviously the Molitor-Gantner connection when they played for so long together. Raleigh Fingers, who came to Milwaukee. And to this day, I'm told by everybody on the 82 team, if he wouldn't have been hurt, they would have won it. Mm. Teddy Higuera, who we mentioned earlier, who came out of Mexico and won 20 games for them. How about Rick Manning becoming one of the first players, maybe the only player ever, to be booed at home because he drove in the winning run to win a game when Paul Molitor was on deck, ending his 39-game hitting streak. You know, Rick Manning said he'll never forget to this day that he got booed for knocking in the winning run at home.
Right.
And, you know, and we, you know, and we've talked a lot about the past, but I take this up through last season, Kathleen. We added the 2007
right.
chapter and the ownership change, and I also deal with what I call the dark years, you know, when they weren't very good. And so this is a soup to nuts offering of the team from the very first day all the way through the last day of last season. So I hope people enjoy the fact that we've tried to cover the entire franchise, and it's not easy to do, and you have to leave out a lot of good stuff when you write
I'm
a book
sure.
like that.
And is it true, as Yost has said, there's nothing left for us to accomplish this year, he was talking about, except winning the division, and is that a possibility?
I think so. I personally think they have a better team this year than they had last year. Now, having said that, some of the other teams are better as well, but there's no reason to think they can't do it.
Yeah. And why do you do it? You cover lots of games. You're away from home and a lot. And what is it about the game that grabs you?
Well, I think what I found out is when you become a baseball writer, within 5 years you either stop or you're in for life. You know, you either get tired of the travel. My wife's been very understanding. I dedicate this book to her because she's a true baseball widow, Trish, because I'm away a lot. There's no question. And, You know that lifestyle, Kathleen.
I know the lifestyle. I mean, I'm living it too. Yep.
So, and it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is hard.
And you do a lot of things over the phone, and you have long distance relationships. But if you're half as understanding to your husband Mike as mine is to me, and I'm sure you are, then that's what makes it work.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom, so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the hour.
So did I. And as I was told, you are the most gracious of hosts, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Hodricourt, the book is Brewers Essential, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Real Fan. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing the show and for on-air production. Thanks for your calls, everybody. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.